Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies and promoting our speaker's book, I Object. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference, brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremedyisinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions and all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Everett for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not that your remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you, Martin. I appreciate you giving us that opportunity to have a disclaimer, and as thorough as it was. We have a first-time caller from Nassau, New York, phone number ending in 3727. Would you be so kind as to offer just your first name only, please? Nassau, New York. Phone number ending in 3727. May we just have your first name only, please?
Carl.
I'm sorry?
Carl. C-A-R-L.
Carl. Oh, thank you, Carl. Pleasure having you on the call. How'd you hear about us tonight?
From another friend.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us. The 30,000-foot view, ladies and gentlemen, tonight is you're going to hear and learn and perfectly understand how you can operate formally as an employee and now as an operative through an LLC without having tax consequences. Also as well, if you're a businessman or woman and you have a current business established, how you can convert whatever entity you have presently today into an LLC that uniquely does not have a tax consequence to it. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin, and he will share with you these great thoughts. Go ahead, Mr. Slevin.
Good evening.
Oh, not again. Can you? This guy loves these old corny vampire movies or something. I just don't pay that attention.
How y'all doing then?
We're fine. Down here in the South, we're just fine.
Yeah. Well, that's where I grew up at. I just like to, you know, play around with the voice once in a while so yeah, everybody can understand. I'm just one of the folks. So it's very good to be with you guys tonight. We'll get right into it. I know more news from Transylvania or anything like that. But so I'd like to set up a little bit about the history, or as we said in the military, which I spent quite a bit of time in. This is a situation report, otherwise known as a SITREP. So the SITREP will start with the Declaration of Independence. It is known as the organic document of this country, published on July 4, 1776. And I suggest ever reading it, or reading it ever so often, so that because it is a masterful work of reason. Now, reason is an extraordinary process ordained by God. In Isaiah 1:18, it says, quote, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins be like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow.
though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool, end quote. Now, these words are a fantastic visual of the process of setting what is perceived to be a wrong, or settling it, rather, and it makes everything right. So when we declared our independence from England by telling the King George III to go pound sand, because we listed his grievance, our grievances against him, what he was doing in the Declaration of Independence, that monarchy or the sovereignty that came down through millennia of what's called the feudal system of Europe, that concept of sovereignty devolved upon we the people. And this is probably stated very well. One of the best statements I've seen of this is from Chisholm v. Georgia, 1793 Supreme Court case. And so this is from page 71. Quote, "The same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence," that would be the courts of Europe, "and constantly reminds us of the distinction between the prince and the subject. No such idea obtains here in the American colonies. At the Revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of this country. But they are sovereigns without subjects, unless," and this is in quotation or parentheses, "unless the African slaves among us may be called so, in paren, and have none to govern but themselves. The citizens of America are equal as fellow citizens and as joint tenants in this sovereignty," end quote. So that says it. You, each of you, as a man, part of mankind, short for man, whether it be wombed or not, so that's where woman comes from, and a man having a womb, are sovereign. You are the boss. You own you. You own all of your production unless you contract it away. And we'll get a little bit more into that contracting situation later. But just to go back to the African slaves that was mentioned in that Supreme Court decision. So, you know, we've been deluged by the things like the 1619 Project, which says America began when the first African slave was brought from that continent. And the Black Lives Matter movement, the critical race theory junk that teaches little children to hate themselves. What more diabolical thing could you be? But anyway, going back to the 1790s and early 1800s, there were most every black person in the, and we, you know, we could refer to them by what they were referred to then as a Negro. Most every Negro in the United States of America were slavery or in some sort of slavery. There was a minor population that were free, and a lot of these freed Negroes owned slaves. So this delusion that these people have, you know, the people that run the CRT thing and the Black Lives Matter, they're just trying to get some of what's yours, which is what all tyrants and villains do. Nonetheless, the come around 1852, I believe, there was a case called Dred Scott, Supreme Court case. This black man, the last name of Dred, sued Dr. Scott because he had been taken into various places that were free states, and he had a wife and a daughter that were purchased. Well, the wife was purchased by Dr. Scott, and then they had two daughters as a result of that marriage. So Mrs. Scott up and sold off the wife and daughters, and Dred sued him because he presumed he was a free man and the extraction of his family was not allowed. So it went to all the way to Supreme Court. It's the longest decision available as to date, some 250 pages. It is quite a good sleep aid if you wish to read it. And all of the justices on the court weighed in. And basically, the general consensus was that the Negro could not be a citizen of the United States of America, that's a capital C citizen, one of the original colonists that joined the Union of the Several States, because of a variety of reasons. And he kind of indicated, the main justice kind of indicated, that Negroes weren't really human. So that was obscene at best. But one of the other justices brought in the writings of, I believe it was Justinian, a 6th century Roman emperor that was writing about when as Rome was deteriorating, he wrote about the free man, the freed man, and the slave, and how those particular parties situated themselves as a citizen or not of Rome, or property of Rome, or property of a Roman citizen. And the interesting thing about that dissertation, here again, if you got the time, it's a really interesting case to read. But the interesting thing about that dissertation was that the Justinian claimed that the status of the person, whether it be free or slave, was transmitted through the mother, regardless of the father's status. So then we come up to the Civil War, and of course, all of that bloodshed and tragedy. And as a result of that, the 13th Amendment, well, the second 13th Amendment, because there's evidence that there was an earlier one that basically wouldn't let lawyers into the government anymore. But anyway, that 13th Amendment was passed in, I believe, 1866 or 5, rather. Anyway, the 13th Amendment outlawed slavery the word escapes me now, but a form of servitude. So the ruling body of the United States of America outlawed the slavery. And if you want to go back and read the Constitution, there's several mentions of slaves and how it was that I believe it was 1800 that no more slaves were allowed to be brought into the country from Africa. And there's several other mentions. But anyway, so the 13th Amendment, as passed, outlawed slavery. So that released the bond on all Negro females at the time. So therefore, anybody born in one of the several states or the District of Columbia was considered free. Then, of course, the things couldn't be left well enough alone. So then they rolled out the 14th Amendment and gave these new freed people a kind of citizenship, but this is a second class citizenship. And GW's work lays that out in detail. So you had this population of recently emancipated people that were not being treated right, so they were given this citizenship. And then came the slaughterhouse cases of 1872. Cruikshank is one of those. And anyway, the Supreme Court says, because the case was brought partially under the 14th Amendment, and the Supreme Court says no, because not all of the class of people, these were butchers and stockyard owners and stuff like that, because the state of Louisiana had given a corporation full power over all of the slaughterhouse business in and around New Orleans. And so the case went all the way up to the court. And the court says, well, you're not all Negroes or people similarly situated, so that bringing it under the 14th Amendment is not it's not a proper way to bring it, because, and it makes this distinction. It said that there are the you have the lowercase c citizens of the United States, as is referenced in the 14th Amendment, and then you have the citizens of the several states, or union states, if you will, and their protection rise under what it did lie under, which is the Bill of Rights. So that case specifically shows these two types of citizenship. But we know we're all born sovereign. So how did those folks, well, obviously the 13th and 14th Amendment would have brought them into this slavery situation under the District of Columbia. So stepping back one more time, the Constitution for the United States was officially ratified and therefore approved on June 21st, 1788. And then the Bill of Rights came along in 1791. And then jump forward, just before Cruikshank, we have the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871. And this was an act of Congress that repealed the individual charters of the cities of Washington and Georgetown, which were within the 10 miles square of the portion allotted to the federal government by the Constitution. This Organic Act established a new territorial government for the whole of District of Columbia. And so this is one, it's also appears to have become a corporation form of doing business. And that's found, one place it's indicated is in 28 United States Code or USC 3002. It says, as used in this chapter 15, United States means a federal corporation. So what did this do to DC? It made it a city-state. It put it in the same class as the City of London, which is one square mile enclave in Greater London, UK, and the Vatican City, which is the 110-acre parcel near the center of Rome, Italy. Now, these three city-states comprise the military, financial, and ecumenical power centers of the earth. And these folks truly believe that they own everything and everybody. And they enforce this belief with merciless efficiency. And if you don't believe me, just try leaving. So here's a little evidence of the ascension to the city-state by the District of Columbia. They started acquiring foreign properties. By 1898, the Spanish War had broken out, and the use of Pearl Harbor grew to great importance. So D.C. acquired those islands as a territory, the Hawaiian Islands, as a territory from Stanford B. Dole of Dole Pineapple. He had stolen it from Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 with the assistance of about 300 U.S. Marines. Also, as a result of the war, D.C. acquired the properties of Cuba, Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Now, Cuba was set free, and which in hindsight may have not been the best course, as they still suffer from the Castro Revolution of the 1950s. The Philippines escaped D.C. in 1946, and they're still a mess. And Guam and Puerto Rico have territories, remain territories of the United States, not the United States of America, of the United States. And there's some rather interesting agency headquartered there. One is the Internal Revenue, or IRS, in Puerto Rico. And a friend of ours defines IRS as, it's really Satan. So nonetheless, D.C. specifically became a city-state by adopting a constitution. Now, this constitution looks very much like the one constitution for the United States approved in 1788, but for one little word. The document adopted by D.C. is the Constitution of the United States. So to understand that difference, we look over here at Wikipedia, and two of the most commonly used prepositions are of and for. These two, like all prepositions, indicate a relationship between objects in a particular sentence. Of is considered an Old English preposition. It means away or away from. The preposition for, on the other hand, initially came from before, which also means on account of. Therefore, by adopting the Constitution of the United States, D.C. can be seen as away from or without the union known as the United States of America. Now, all these machinations that I've just described are come at the hands of lexicographers, or lexicos for short. They are wordsmiths of the nth degree, and they can do some amazing work. But as we know from our military days, if it ain't written down, it didn't happen. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States shows what a lexicographer is from Merchants Loan and Trust v. Simtanka in 1921. At 28, it says, in determining the definition of the word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what is believed to be commonly understood meaning of the term that must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Just as an aside, so the Supreme Court now claims clairvoyance because they know what must have been in the minds of people. So these lexicos, the way they write is quantified by a thing called the Flesch Index. It is a scale that measures the English language. It goes from 1 to 100. Now, as an example, a common newspaper is written at 8.5. A typical first-year college student understands around 11. And a law school graduate, some guy with like 8 years of school, of higher learning, if you will, comprehends around 15. The tax code in particular, the Internal Revenue Code, is written at an average of 33 with pieces as high as 55. In other words, they have no intention of explaining or being clear about taxation. And they really can't because, as I'll soon show, it's really very simple. And if they just maintain the simplicity of it, everybody would understand what their quote-unquote fair share is. And it'd be all fine, but they can't do that. Just because they, I'm pretty sure they have evil in their heart, pretty black. So in order to be legitimate, the taxing statute must have three particulars. They are the subject of the tax, the measure of the tax, as well as a statement of liability. Now, this statement is obviously the most important to the we the people, because if you don't know you owe something, then you would – you know, and then it becomes a surprise. That's a bad surprise. So that statement is very, very important. And here again, the lexicographers just don't say that in plain language or understandable language for the vast majority of Americans. So the Constitution for the United States designates there are two great classes of taxation. They are direct, which is applied by apportionment, as well as indirect, which are required to be uniform throughout the several states. Now, there's three categories of taxables. They are people, property, and activities. And as I usually do this face-to-face, I say, can you think of anything else that's out there? No. So direct taxes are applied to people and property via census enumeration and valuation. So a census, what is that? That's counting all the noses. And then everybody with a nose pays a certain amount of tax. That's a flat tax. It's a capitation tax. Enumeration is the same thing. Valuation is when you do property. And at the time of the Constitution, the main property was land and slaves. So the valuation takes place, and then the owner of the property pays a small percentage, typically small percentage, of the property as a tax. So if you pay your property tax, which I just happened to write a check this evening about one, on the property, you will probably see something on that tax bill called the millage rate. The mill is short for a thousandth. And so the millage rate might be 7 or 7.2. And that means that for every $1,000 the property is worth, the tax is somewhere around $7 or something in that general range. Anyway, so the indirect taxes, which is most appropriately are described as an excise, when then they're placed on activities. However, there must be some way devised to measure the activity. So you've got, you know, census and valuation for people and property, but there's got to be somewhere to because there's a myriad of activities. So the way that it has come down to do this is by they can calculate the production. In other words, I can hire somebody to count everything that happens in that activity, or they can put a flat fee on something necessary. To demonstrate this, and this is the measure of the tax, to demonstrate this measure, I always ask, is there an excise tax on whiskey? No, because since whiskey is property, it therefore can't be an excise tax on it because it is property. It is some physical thing. It is liquid in a bottle. So the activity, what makes whiskey? Well, that activity would be distillation. So the subject of the tax is the privileged activity of distillation and the measure being the containers of whiskey. Or they could put a flat fee on the capacity of the distillery. Either way, there is a stamp label placed on all the bottles to show that the tax has been paid. And that's the way that they've come about figuring out how to do this. So the 16th Amendment says, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. So as the explanation before shows, this tax that the Congress now has the power to lay must be an excise tax. It must be on an activity. But income is not an activity. So therefore, it must be the measure. Now, this is one quote where the Supreme Court, and this is from Dole v. Mitchell Brothers, which is a 1918 case at page 185, quote, whatever difficulty there may be about the price and specific in definition of income, it imports, as used here, something entirely distinct from principal or capital, either as a subject of taxation or as a measure of the tax, conveying rather the idea of gain or increase arising from corporate activities. As said in the Stratton Independent v. Hobart case, quote, income may be defined as the gain derived from capital, from labor, or from both combined. The Supreme Court just could have come out and explained that there's two types of taxes, direct and excise, and there's three taxables, people, property, and activities, and made it that simple, okay? But even then, they have to contort things so that typical people that speak English can't even understand what they're talking about. Now, Congress has been barred from taxing anything that sustains the right to life, okay? So I believe that was Mayberry versus Madison. They attached the taxes on income to something which had been applied for or chartered, as related to the Supreme Court in Flint v. Stone Tracy, which is a 1911 case, at 151, quote, the tax under consideration, as we have construed the statute, may be described as an excise upon the particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity, i.e., with the advantages that arise from corporate or quasi-corporate organization, or when applied to insurance companies, for doing business of such companies. And then down at the next page, it's 152, it says, if business is not done in this manner described in the statute, no tax is payable, period. So later on in that case, it also said that a private firm is not subject to the income tax. Now, not subject to is the synonyms for that are not liable or immune. And I want to take a second here to show the difference between immune and exempt. In law, if you're immune, just like if you're immune in your body, you do not fit the category. So if you're immune from the most recent Chinese virus, you can't get it under any circumstances. That's what immunity is. Exemption means that the legislators that are enacting this tax say, yes, you fit the profile in as far as the income tax is going. You are a corporation, but we're in our largesse because you're a particular type of corporation, we will exempt you from the penalty. So that's the difference in immune and exempt. All of this contortion of the language to implement an income tax comes down today in Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code. And it says, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. All right? Well, that happens to be Chapter 1. And the title of Chapter 1 is Normal Taxes and Surtaxes. And if you go back to the 1913 Revenue Act, which was in October after the February, supposedly the 16th Amendment had been ratified, they wrote in that particular law, they called it the normal tax. You know, clearly trying to deceive people. So the and just as a reinforcement, the second sentence of Section 701 reads, persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for income tax only in their separate or individual capacities. So that goes right back to our earlier explanation. The actual subject of the tax is carrying on business, and it's only business in the corporate capacity. And those doing that, whether they be partners or principals or peons, then yeah, that business is part of the is liable for the income tax. So this is an explanation of how we have the subject, the measure, and the statement of liability. And every taxing statute must have that in it in order to be legitimate. But the lexicos and lexicographers and the other people that are writing this junk up in D.C. and in the state houses, for that matter, can't let it be that simple. They must deceive. That's all they try to do. So, as it said earlier in 701, it talked about partnership. So, if we've ever learned anything about reading law, then you understand that when the legislator writing the law or the statute, if you will, defines a specific word or phrase in the statute, one must use that definition when reading the section it applies to. So when we go back and look at 701 and we see the term partnership, we have to look for where that's done at, and that's way over in 7701, some 2 million words later. In definitions A, it says, when used in this title, which means the entire Title 26, also known as the Internal Revenue Code, were not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly incompatible with the intent thereof, don't you love it? One, the term person, remember persons up in the 701, the term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company, or corporation. And then we go to number two, and it says the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. So when one goes and gets a limited liability company from one of the several state secretary of state, then they get a certificate of organization. So we can read 701, and it says, an LLC, as such, shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, being chapter 1. So, while we're over here in 7701, I just got to read you this one. It says at A20, it says, for the purposes of applying the provisions of Section 79 with respect to, and then it goes about on about a 100-word rant, and all the way down at the bottom it says, the term employee shall include a full-time life insurance salesman who is considered an employee for the purposes of Chapter 21, end quote. Now, that Chapter 21 is where we find the FICA tax. All right, so where did this come from? As I said, in 1909, the federal legislators wrote the revenue law, and it said there is hereby imposed an excise tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. And then Flint v. Stone Tracy allowed them to drop the excise and drop the with respect to, and so it was just a tax on income. So, and we know that that's what they did because we get over here to the 1935 Social Security Act, and which was done in 11 separate titles because FDR knew that if one fell, if it was separated like that and one fell, it wouldn't take the rest of the junk down with it. So if you look at Title 8, and, oh, by the way, reading the original bill on the Social Security is very enlightening. There is some stuff in there that you just will not believe. Nonetheless, in Title 8 of the Social Security Act of 1935, we have a tax upon income with respect to employment. Okay, so employment is a relationship between an employer and an employee. But then so we have this employee thing, and it says, you know, for the purposes of applying this position, the term employee shall include a full-time life insurance salesman. As far as the definitions for the Title 26 go. But in the 1935 Social Security Act, they said that this employment tax is in Title 11, but then over in Title 8, but over in Title 11, they did some more definition swapping, and they said that the employee is defined, or the term employee includes the officer of a corporation, and period. And that brings it all the way back to the 1909 Act. So you can see how, you know, that when they needed to use the language specifically, they put with it that phrase in with respect to. And otherwise, they just did shorthand. But Americans reading it have no idea of the shorthand terminology of this. So they kind of think, well, yeah, I'm an employee because I work for somebody. I work for an employer. And that's the deceit that this whole situation has brought about on us. Also in the 1935 Social Security Act, they redefined includes and including, which comes down in the present day code at section 7701C, and it says the term includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this title, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the meaning of the term defined. If you do a sentence diagram on that thing, it comes out there's about three sets of double negatives. So when you take out those double negatives, it comes down like this. The terms includes and including, when used in this definition, are deemed to be only the things within the term defined. So when you define a term and it has several things that are part of that term, only that stuff in the list is what is falls under this definition. So when it said in 1935 Social Security Act, the term employee includes the officer of a corporation, that can also be read, the term employee is only the officer of a corporation, which again ties it back to 1909. So that's the sit rep. And now I'd like to explain how our company uses all of this verbiage to allow people to do business income tax free. So our product is called a private firm from Flint v. Stone Tracy, and it's based on a limited liability company organized in the state of New Mexico. And I'm sure most of you go, well, why New Mexico? Really cool things go on in that particular set of legislation. So when one applies to the Secretary of State of New Mexico to get a limited liability organized, they do that through the Articles of Organization. In the Articles, it requires a minimum of two parties, the organizer and the registered agent, both of which can be other limited liability companies. Now, you can probably, you're a bunch of smart folks out there, you can probably see how you can see, so you got LLCs on the paperwork of the state that own LLCs, on the paperwork of the state that own LLCs, and so on, back several layers. That's what we have, this, our company has constructed. So we go down and we fill out the Articles of Organization. Secretary of State of New Mexico hands us a certificate of organization for this new company, and we'll use the label XYZ LLC for our example. So then XYLOZ certificate, one of our other people who has never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return, takes that certificate, goes to the IRS and says, hey, I need an employer identification number or EIN for my new company. And they say, well, I'll fill this out. So it goes down and fills it out. And at that point, that individual is known as the sole member of XYZ LLC at that point in time when dealing with the IRS. So the IRS issues a EIN to XYZ LLC, and that individual, because he's now the sole member, has a meeting. And at that meeting, they do a resolution to create or to commission a third party as a manager, because manager is the only officer of a limited liability company. In corporations, you have president, CEO, board of directors, all of these different officers. In partnerships, which is the third statutory business form, you have limited partners and general partners. In corporations, the owners are called shareholders or stockholders because they actually own a share of the company. In partnerships as well as LLCs, the owners are the members, and the members hold percentages of membership. So you've got the for an LLC, you've got one and only officer is a manager. Now you can put as any kind of thing in front of it as you want, you know, chief executive or chief bottle washer or whatever, but manager is the only officer. And then you have the membership. It's a percentage of membership that does not limit it to 100. You can break it down to 0.001% and have a million percentage certificates for that limited liability company. So once the individual in our company that goes and has the certificate of organization, he has the EIN paperwork, giving that a thing. Back about going in and getting that, when you go on the website and you're applying to do an LLC, it asks a question. It says, why is this LLC requesting an EIN? And the five first ones are started a new business, hired employees for banking purposes, and it used to say for banking purposes only, change type of organization or purchase active business. Now, so we select banking purposes because it says under here, it says select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or local law. Do you hear anything about taxes there? So we know from Section 701 that the LLC is not subject to the tax, not liable for or immune from it, to the income tax. And so this piece on the IRS website says, yep, if you want to do that, you just need it for banking purposes only, because obviously you're immune to the tax. So the individual commission the manager. So the manager then takes the commission, the EIN paperwork, and the certificate of organization down to a bank and gets XYZ LLC a checking account. And we do our best to get one that's got full electronic banking and a debit card and checks and everything, you know, full, so you get the full boat. Once that's all done, the new manager brings it back to the office, and the guy who was, or gal who was the sole member at that point, transfers the ownership back to our company, because our company was the organizer on the articles of organization, and therefore it is presumed to be the sole member on the paperwork in the Secretary of State of New Mexico's website. So we bring all that back to the office. We pair up a pay-as-you-go cell phone with it, and we pre-program it with the electronic banking, and we like to use Square App and Cash App. Square App is a point of sale, and then Cash App is a peer-to-peer transfer device. Both of these work really well. Tune that all up, make sure everything works, make sure there's money in the accounts, get it all together, and then transfer it to the client. And we do this privately. So literally the client then opens the box up and pulls all the stuff out, fires up the cell phone, and now XYZ LLC can take payments for whatever it sells, whether it's widgets or services or fruitcakes, and they can take payments for these items by debit card or credit card or a check. And, of course, cash is always accepted. So the company XYZ LLC in our example is now fully formed and doing business. And how much business it does is entirely up to the new client, because this is all done independent of anybody's situation or past FUPAs or anything like that. It's a brand new thing, and all business done under that LLC is income tax free worldwide. So that's pretty much it. What are your questions?
All right. Thank you so very, very much. That's a great presentation. I've got a little housekeeping to do here. I've got a few questions of my own, and then I'd like to open it up for the group to ask their questions. For you, press star 2 on your keypad, star 2 on your keypad. It's just underneath your number 7. And then hit the star 2, and on my end, I will see your name pop up with your hand raised, and I'll open up your microphone. You can talk to Mr. Slevin directly. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see to the center right of your monitor shape of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. If you left-click inside of that rectangle, then you can type away your comment or your question, and I'll be delighted to give voice. You'll see underneath the rectangle a place to put your name and some other information. Hit submit, and then I'll pop up on my end, and I can give voice. So, and if you don't, nobody raises their hand, we're going to have a really short call tonight. We have a first-time caller from Greensboro, North Carolina, ending in 7711, the phone number ending in 7711. Would you be so kind as to share with us your first name only, please? Greensboro, North Carolina, ending in 7711. First name only, please. Or not. All right.
I didn't have any questions, sorry.
No, I was just asking for your first name, please.
Oh, Anthony.
Anthony. Thank you, Anthony. How'd you hear about us?
I just recently came across your guys' website, and so I was just trying to gain a little bit more information.
Sure.
So I just hopped on. So, yep.
Wonderful idea. Thank you.
Yep.
And I hope you enjoy your call tonight with us. I hope you, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. Again, press star 2 on your keypad. Couple things I wanted to cover with you, Mr. Slevin, is I had been the investigations that I had with regards to the United States for America versus the United States of America. When something is for something, it's intimated that the one that is doing something for another is the superior partner, if you would, or the superior party to whatever's going on. So an example would dad did something for one of his children as an example.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the for. And then of is a possession. For instance, the United States of the United States of America, right, is saying that the United States is possessing it. The Constitution of the United States of America is saying that the United States possesses this Constitution, as mm-hmm. opposed to it being prepared for the United States. So that was the primary two differences, is that for the United States of America was showing a superior position of the United States, was showing that it was what that they were the superior party. Anyways, that's that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing, and just as a point of information, and I'd love for people to go run with this, 25 years ago, I got fascinated by a pastor that said, can anyone tell, in a Bible study, can anybody tell me what word is in the entirety of the scriptures? So they were talking about the Old Testament, the New Testament. What one word is there? Not the word of or the or anything like that, but an actual pronoun or a noun. What word is there? And with my background in parochial school education and so forth, I was doing my computer thing in the brain. I couldn't come up with a single word that was there almost 7,000 times. And what I ended up learning was that the name of the Almighty One, which King James translated as the Lord, was actually in the original Hebrew script. When you go back to that today, even you can go to a Jewish synagogue today and you can look it up in the Hebrew Kumash, is what it's called for their Bible. You'll see where that word the Lord is in King James. It'll say Yud Heh Wah Heh, and they'll use the word Hashem for the name. But in the actual Hebrew writing, it'll be Yud Heh Wah Heh. So that was like 25, 30 years ago, and that got me started in actually learning to go to the source of the writing of our scriptures that we have today, which was and is the ancient Greek Septuagint, written 250 years before our Messiah, our Redeemer, kinsman, came to this earth, to this land, as an advent. And so I began to actually study scriptures in the Greek, reading line by line the English. And one thing that I learned was that the word human is the Greek word anthropinos, and the word man is the Greek word anthropos. So even as long as nearly 2,300 years ago, the Greeks knew to differentiate as two different entities who the humans were and who the men or man was. And I just thought that was fascinating. So the founding fathers, they knew Greek. They wrote Greek in the Greek language. It was part of their higher education. And when they wrote the word man, in a contract. They were talking about a specific entity called Anthropos. They weren't talking about Anthropinos or anything else. So I just thought that that was interesting, and I wanted to share that with you because of what you had brought up with the Founding Fathers, Mr. Slevin.
Very good. Thank you.
Sure. Press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to say goodnight early without any questions. While you're thinking about hitting that button, I'm going to check Freedom's Radio to see if anybody has written in a question or comment there. Otherwise, I'm going to be embarrassed and not have anybody ask questions tonight, which will be disheartening. There we go. Thank you for bailing us out, Ron. Ron in Cocoa, Florida. Go ahead, buddy.
Do you have your transcript in, available that you could email or otherwise transmit to me for further review? Hearing it weekly is fine, but it's hard to retain the information.
Sure. You should be able to go to www.freedomsradio.com, Freedoms Radio. Look where it says archives. Click on that. A calendar will pop up. Look for the calendar date that you're looking for to listen to an archive, and you should be able to either stream it there live on your broadband, or you can download it to your hard drive and, you know, hear, listen to it without being streaming. It'll be just a recording playback. That's number one. Number two, we are temporarily, and we haven't built it yet, so we're in the process of building it right now, at American by Birth. We're putting that in place as well, a section where you can listen to the recordings for Mr. Slevin there. I will be, as soon as I can get into it, I will be creating a website for Mr. Slevin only, just his work that he's doing. And then we'll host the archives there permanently. I just haven't figured out how I'm going to do that yet. Probably under your remedy is in the law, maybe. I don't know. We'll figure that out. Does that answer your question, Ron?
Hey, well, yes. You've only got it in audio. You do not have it in script at this time.
Oh, no. We don't transcript. Don't have that ability yet. So that's
okay.
What you're asking. Yeah. You want it written. Okay.
I want it written, so
I will pass.
Refer back.
Yeah. I will pass that on to our programmer to see if he can just find a free transcription service that can take the audio and convert it. We'll see what we can do with that. It's a good idea.
Well,
I think that.
If I might, every smartphone now, you could just play it onto the smartphone and it'll transcript it for you.
Really?
Yeah,
but you've got to be smartphone smart to do that.
Yeah, you got to be smarter than the stuff than the pieces of equipment that you use. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't got a 12-year-old that can educate me, so I'm in deep trouble. At nearly 8 years old, it
truer
may take a while.
Truer words were never spoken. Truer words were never spoken. Wow.
But we'll work
any
it
other
out.
Questions?
We'll no, that's the primary question. I understand the theory.
All right. Anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad. I'd hope to have a relevant question for Mr. Slevin regarding his services. If not, we're going to say goodnight and thank Mr. Slevin for his time tonight that he's given us, which is really a shame not to exploit his time while we have it without cost. All right. Well, Mr. Slevin, I want to thank you for joining us this evening. It's a great presentation. And welcome everybody back next week. We're reminding you that Saturday is about asset protection with Justice Beshear. Monday is about correcting your status, which Mr. Slevin spoke about earlier in this call tonight. That's on Monday. Tuesday is regarding the two things. One is either John will be speaking or a fellow that likes to call himself Johnny Ringo, who was the lead investigator for the late Mr. Tony Davis regarding Title 18. So these are all great calls. It's the same phone number, the same PIN, and the same time, just different nights of the week. And different speakers. Until then, I want to say goodnight, everybody. Let me just refresh one more time, see if we got anybody here. Don't want to miss out on that. No. Good night, everybody. Until next week, be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.